Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have an all-new, brand-new, never-before-heard special. No, it's not a repeat, not a hoax, not a dream, not an imaginary story. Instead, it is a very cool special hour on native plants that we taped when I did an event for donors of public radio at the Schuylkill Valley Nature Center, walking through aisles of native plants with Andrew Kirkpatrick, manager of land stewardship for the Schuylkill Center. Now you can be a bug on the wall and listen to our conversation. So one of the things I love that you've done here is, this is the year of the pollinator, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah? Is you've arranged them by seasonality. Because one of the things, if we're going to protect pollinators, if we're going to encourage pollinators on our property, on our landscape, and I'm going to digress, first of all. The pollinators that you get on your property are not going to sting you. Native bees don't have stingers. They don't even care about you that much. Honeybees do have stingers, but unless you have a beehive nearby, you're probably not going to have honeybees. And again, they have no interest in coming to sting you. They've got work to do. All of the so-called bee stings that occur in the United States, I believe, are the result of wasps. Yellow jackets, hornets.
Yep.
Yeah. So attracting native bees will give you more fruits, more flowers, improve the environment, and with no threat of stinging. And also, if you plant these plants, if you watch them bloom, go outside someday, just pull up a chair and just sit there. Because after 20 minutes, I might see 15, 16 different kind of native bees,
yep.
Some of which are obvious, like bumblebees and carpenter bees, but some of which are these diaphanous little long golden bees with these fragile spun gold wings,
yeah,
that are just amazing. Some of the pollinators, some of the native bees are so small you can barely see them.
Right.
But they do a tremendously effective job of giving us more flowers and in the end more food.
Yeah.
So the first thing you got up is two honeysuckles. Where's the Japanese honeysuckle? Come on,
oh,
man.
It's very fragrant, but it's not native, and it's the one you'll see most often around. So we have two of the southern bush honeysuckles, which are similar to the vines, but grow in a bush form. Same kind of blossom that the pollinators like, the bees like, and they'll spread on their own. So, you know, you plant one, it'll fill in over time. So it's sort of a return on your investment.
This one almost looks like a hosta.
Right.
A variegated hosta.
Yeah, and it's a cultivar. It's the cool splash. So, you know, you can get that sort of color and interest that you find in non-native plants, but with something that also benefits the bees.
So you're not being, like, speciesist here. As
right.
long as it benefits the pollinators,
yep,
you're good. Let's move down. What do you like here? I mean, Blue Star has such a tremendous reputation.
Yeah, this Indian pink is amazing, too. Really nice red color at this time of year.
And you can see the double color still,
yep,
on these plants.
Yeah, and it's sort of, you know, the native color of spring is always white. People think of yellow because lesser celandine pops up. But it's the bloodroot is sort of the hallmark of spring. So you get those nice white colors coming in the early spring, and then you sort of get some blues, you know, with like your blue flag iris. And so now as we head into June, you're looking for more like reds and oranges with the butterfly weed.
But in terms of bees, whether they're native bees or honey bees, you just named two of their favorite three colors.
Yes.
White and bluish violet.
Yep.
The other being yellow.
We have plants set up outside the visitor center, and daily I've been seeing the hummingbirds coming to the fire pinks, and they zip in and zip out.
Yeah, there's three secrets to attracting hummingbirds. The color red,
yep.
The color red, and the color red.
Yep.
Well, that's why the feeders are always red.
Because if you want more hummingbirds, believe it or not, and you got a red feeder filled with red fluid, put red ribbons around it.
Yeah.
They are just attracted from long distances by the color red.
Yeah.
So what about the Coreopsis?
I love it. It's got that nice kind of orangey yellow color. And again, it's one of these ones that'll spread, fill in over time. It's one of the deer-resistant ones. Can't guarantee you that they won't chomp it, but it's one of the last ones they'll go for. It also takes drought pretty well.
Okay, so mid-season, what do we got? What do you like back here?
That's when we start moving into like the brown-eyed Susan, the black-eyed Susan. The obedient plant is really nice. That gets nice, big, tall. It has more of the white color, and it's a long bloom. You know, it goes from July to September. The Eupatorium is really nice. The woodland Joe Pye weed, that'll get a nice, really blue, pink blossom. And we have the woodland Joe Pye weed. There's also the three-nerve Joe Pye weed. So there's a couple different varieties of Joe Pye. And they'll take the wetter soils. So, you know, if you have a little bit of clay, you can grow those. They'll take that period of inundation well.
And Big Blue Stem, I mean, this is a plant that is adored by native plant enthusiasts, right?
Yeah, it's just an amazing grass, you know. It grows tall. You get that nice sort of bluish
color.
Color
changes.
They call it a turkey foot, too, because it sort of looks like the foot of a turkey.
And although people don't understand this, it's one of the things that's hardest for people to understand sometimes, is there are no lawn grasses that are native to anywhere near the United States. This is probably the closest to a native grass people are going to get.
Right.
And when you're growing a turf grass, you're growing something from either Europe or Asia.
Absolutely.
Oh, the blue stem. That's a remarkable four-season plant.
Yeah, I mean, really, that's just year-round color.
Yeah,
texture.
It's like a flicker ring. It's just going to keep changing for you.
You can cut it in the late November, or you can leave it and just have the stems blowing in the wind in the winter. I usually cut mine down in like early spring in March so that the new stuff has room to grow.
Same as ornamental grasses. What I recommend is you let them brown out.
Yep.
Leave the and it's you never prune anything in the fall. There's a simple pruning rule for fall. It's a little mnemonic you can remember. Nothing! Nothing! If you're outside with pruners in your hand in the fall, you are bored. Take up woodworking. Watch the World Series. Send the pruners off to a friend in Asia and ask them to ship them back to you very slowly. Because all you can do is damage. Anything you leave standing of a plant, especially a native plant, in the fall is going to be winter protection.
Yeah.
This part of the plant may be brown, but it's going to hold snow cover. It's going to protect the plant from a heavy frost. It's going to manage the root system so much better. It's going to protect the crown. Then in the spring, resist the temptation. Let the brown stand into the spring, and then you've experienced this. You get this light in the center. You get this beautiful lime green in the center as the new growth comes up. And the longer you can wait to take off the brown, which you don't have to do at all.
You can leave it.
It looks like there's a little miniature nightlight in the middle of the plant. It's just a great effect. You can only get it if you leave the poor thing alone. Just less is so much more.
Absolutely.
When it comes to gardening. Experience all four seasons of the plant. All right, what else? Oh, coneflowers.
Yep.
These are such valuable plants. I mean, these are great things to plant at this time of year. One thing, if you are going to be planting at this time of year, the worst thing you can do with any plant is to plant it first thing in the morning. That's our instinct. Get up, have our coffee, have our tea, go out in the garden, put the plant in the ground, maybe mess up the roots as we're putting it in.
Yep.
And then we look at it around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and that's when you accuse your spouse of running over it with a car.
Or your child.
Yeah. Because it's just, all plants are going to get transplant shock. And if you put it into the ground early in the morning on a day where it's going to get like 9 hours of brutal sun, it's going to lay down and take a nap, perhaps for a long time. Whereby that same plant, if you wait till around now, beautiful time of the evening, it's always cooler, not necessarily this cool, but you put it in the ground now, it's got that whole evening to acclimate. It gets to go to sleep, it gets to wake up. By the time it has to take a real nasty hit of sun, it's been in the ground for well over 12 hours.
Right.
So, and it didn't cost you anything. Nicer time of day to be out.
Have a glass of wine instead of a cup of coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you can't have enough cone flowers.
Absolutely. My garden is full of them.
And one thing you're telling me about the pinks, to my brain, such as it is, the flowers, they're the right color, they're the right shape, they're tubular red flowers.
Right.
But I would have thought they were too small for hummingbirds to be interested in.
Right. No, they'll come. A couple of different sizes of the hummingbirds, and they'll get right in there.
With a plant like this, you get your hummingbirds without worrying if a vine is invasive.
Right.
Or going to cause problems.
Or the trumpet honeysuckle that will grow up your house.
Right, exactly. And in 10 years, the honeysuckle will be there.
Yep.
But your house won't.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that you're listening to a very special all-new broadcast of You Bet Your Garden, taped live at the Schuylkill Valley Nature Center this past June. Coming up next, we review the attributes of dozens more native plants, including their bloom time throughout the season, to help you find the perfect plants for your personal property. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden, taped live at the Schuylkill Valley Nature Center and brought to you by WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden, coming to you live on tape from the Schuylkill Valley Nature Center just outside of Philadelphia. In June of this year, we had a great member event for members of WHYY, the station that You Bet Your Garden is produced out of. It's one thing we don't talk about, but when you are a member of your public radio station, you're going to get invited to all kinds of special events, and this one was truly special. Our members and I gathered at the Schuylkill Valley Nature Center with Andrew Kirkpatrick, their manager of land stewardship. We were just going to have a discussion about native plants, but then I noticed that they had these hordes of native plants all set out in long rows with great identifying markers, and it turned out they were going to have their big annual native plant sale that coming weekend, and the plants had just been put out and were untouched. So we scrapped our original idea of just giving these dry talks, and Andrew and I walked up and down these lanes of plants while I picked out ones that I liked, he picked out ones that he liked, and we got to discuss them in great detail. So coming up next, we're going to use milkweed to attract monarch butterflies. We're going to explain how goldenrod got a bad rap in the allergy season and which plant is the real culprit that makes you sneeze, how to use different varieties of native grasses to create different textures in your yard. We're going to talk about sedum and so much more. So let's get back to my time with Andrew Kirkpatrick, manager of land stewardship for the Schuylkill Valley Nature Center.
One of the things you have to remember, too, when you have deer problems, is plants are differently attractive to deer when they're young. I don't care how deer-resistant a plant is when it's 4 or 5 years old. If it's been in the ground 3 months, the deer are going to eat the roots. They're going to eat it right down.
Yep.
As deer-resistant plants get older, they get tougher, they get thornier, but even those plants, the new green growth every year is going to be very attractive. There's no magic answer there. And deer are changing the landscape.
Absolutely.
So what's this? I don't recognize this plant from here.
The tall one?
Yeah.
That's the blue vervain. It likes full sun. It takes wet soil. It doesn't always have a long lifespan throughout the season, but you can see it's starting to get these real delicate.
Oh, they're beautiful,
flowers. Yeah, purplish blue.
And again, this is one of the top colors for pollinators. That kind of violety, lightish blue, that purplish blue.
Right.
A big block of this is going to be covered with pollinators. When I say bees, I'm not talking about anything that you're thinking of. The diversity, I'm sure you've counted hundreds out here. I've counted over 40 native bees on my property, distinctively different ones.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just a joy to watch.
They are. They all have sort of their own habits.
None of the males have stingers. Some of the females have stingers, but they don't use them. There's entomologists who've studied native bees for 40 years and never been stung.
Yep. They're not interested in you.
No. But they do want your pollen.
They do, if you have it.
Yes. And they'll give you more flowers as a result.
Yep.
Minorda.
That is the favorite, the fistulosa, and then there's also the didyma, the bee balm. And that's a great one for, the birds, the hummingbirds, the butterflies. They'll all come for that.
And this is also the plant that produces the essential oil, right?
Right. Keep away your mosquitoes.
The bergamot, one of the most expensive
of
the essential oils, right? Gay feather, which is like used to be a poster child for native plants, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's a prairie species. I mean, it grows around here too, but you know, it gets those deep roots, and you'll get that really nice upright stalk of color. This is a white cultivar, so you know you can have some of that white in the summer.
And again, the more white flowers you have, and the bigger block. Were you to take all of these and plant them in a big block, within a couple of years, that would be the best bee attractor in the neighborhood.
Right.
Butterfly weed.
Yes. This is a great one. It has amazing orange clusters of flowers. Again, the bees just love it. And, you know, it takes the wet soil, can take dry soil. It's great for monarchs. And it's a really a striking flower.
But it's a host plant.
Yes.
Okay, so they're going to eat it.
Yes. And it also, it does attract, there's a bug.
Well, no, because there's two plants or two types of plants that if you want to see monarchs that you put into the ground. One is some form of milkweed or another so that the butterfly will instinctively lay her eggs on that host plant. And the caterpillar will eat it. You wouldn't believe. Of course you would. How many people call into my show, I planted milkweed and something ate it.
Right.
I can't stand being a success. But then, at the end of the season, in late August, in September, the adult monarchs are getting ready to go back down to Mexico. And they need hugely effective sources of pollen and nectar then in a different form to fuel that journey.
Yep.
So that's, again, the importance of having something in bloom.
All year, all season.
All season, especially at the end of the season. If you want to keep monarchs going, you feed the babies. But then the adults, they have to give up their liquids at the airport. They got to, you know, they got to get a nectar and pollen boost from you before they can make that big trip. So here's another Joe Pye.
Yep, this is a three-nerved.
Doesn't have the blossoms yet.
But again, you'll get sort of a pink color at the top, and
it'll get pretty tall, you know, 3 to 4 feet.
And again, Joe Pye weed is one of the plants that started the native plant movement.
Absolutely.
Really. So these are all plants that are going to be in bloom pretty soon.
Yeah, they're coming.
Okay.
Do you know who Joe Pye was?
Do you?
No.
Okay.
You got to send me an email.
The legend says he was a Native American down like in the South somewhere, but nobody's sure.
I know who Radiator Charlie was. But that's because tomatoes are us. Now, wood aster, there's a plant I've heard a lot about, but I don't know that I've seen it a lot. And it looks beautiful down there.
Yeah, it's a great one. And it's not one that you'll find a lot in people's gardens, but it's an important host species. Again, it's like the pollinators, the bees, the butterflies, the hummingbirds, you know, they all will come to it. And it's got that nice blue flower, and that's through most of the summer you'll get that, you know, June, July, August.
But how can you sell goldenrod?
Goldenrod is a great flower.
It's going to make you sneeze.
No, it's a lie. It's not the goldenrod. Don't blame goldenrod.
One of the great misconceptions in allergies is because the goldenrod is so showy at the time when people's fall weed allergies show up, goldenrod gets the blame because it is so obvious. I mean, it's like Lady Godiva out in the wild.
It must be the one.
But there is just a ratty just plant that you'll never look twice at called ragweed, and that's the one that's putting all the wind-blown pollen into the air. One of the nice things about when you buy plants for pollinators, by definition, they're non-allergic because pollinators are pollinators. They're going to come. The insects move the pollen from flower to flower. Other plants rely on the wind. Most trees are wind pollinated.
Dandelions.
Ragweed is wind pollinated. But if you see bees coming to a plant, you may choose to believe that that plant is activating your allergies, but you're wrong.
Right.
Because literally, it's just the pollens that we inhale. And plants long ago evolved to make a choice. They would either produce attractive pollen and nectar to get insects to do the job of going out and finding them dates, or they would send so much copious pollen into the air that they would take care of the issue that way. And it's the windblown pollens that give us our allergies.
Yes.
And goldenrod, you know, because of that, and I don't need to tell you, it might be the most underutilized.
It really is. And there's so many varieties, too. There's the showy goldenrod, the old field goldenrod, the rough-stemmed goldenrod.
Well, the fireworks wasn't that the plant of the year a couple years ago or something like that?
So there's a lot of great choices, too. And, you know, they give you that late summer yellow, and that's sort of the color I have associated with that part of the season, too. You know, you're heading into the fall, but you're not quite there yet. Everything kind of gets that golden glow in the
last days. Oh, it just catches your eye. Yeah.
Yep, definitely.
And here's another native grass.
It's a great one, the switchgrass. And it sort of gets that, like, you know, greenish-bluish seed head. It has a nice tuft. It gets pretty tall. And it takes the shade, it'll take sun, wet, dry. You can pretty much plant it anywhere.
So silver bell, boy, I wish this was in bloom.
Right.
This is a great looking plant.
Great tree. There is an invasive one too, the Japanese silver bell, the styrax, which is really nasty and invasive. And this is the native one, the Carolina silver bell, and it gets really beautiful blossoms. And you can see now even it has that very distinct kind of a seed pod.
And it's going to bloom in partial shade?
Yep.
Medium soil. What's that? Nobody has medium soil.
It's the ideal.
Yeah.
It's wet. It's not dry. It's not soaked.
I know purple love grass. I remember that from the 60s. Curly grass I'm not familiar with.
This is one, at our spring plant sale, I had people coming up to me looking for lawn alternatives that could take full sun but weren't going to get tall.
Grower,
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like your Indian grass or your blue stem where they're going to get huge and cover things up, you know. The curly grass is something that you can plant in place of your turf lawn. You won't have to mow it. It has nice color, nice texture, nice seed head, and it's a host plant for skippers.
Which are beautiful butterflies.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'll take the purple lovegrass for the height, for the drama.
I always like a little height.
Yeah. Sedum. Did I see you have a green roof here somewhere?
We do.
So there's got to be a lot of sedum up there.
There is. That takes the heat and the dry very well. It will flourish in it.
Well, and you can't really kill sedums.
It's really hard.
You know, they are pretty bulletproof plants. Every year when my kids were a certain age, my wife and I grew up going to Wildwood.
Yep.
So as soon as the kids were old enough to walk the boards, we took them down to Wildwood first for 2 nights, then for 3 nights. But the places were so lame.
Yeah.
And then we finally asked a realtor, you know, what's a nice place to stay for a week? And she said, oh, you rent a condo. And we went and checked this condo at the very south end of the boardwalk, Ocean Towers. And as we're leaving this 3-bedroom condo that we're liking a lot, I look up on the roof, 12 stories high, and there's this, what appears to be a bunker up there. And I go, what's that? And she goes, oh, that's the penthouse. The guy who built the condos loved the view from the roof so much that he built himself a special apartment that you enter on the 12th floor, but then there's a set of floating steps that takes you up to this other floor, and it's the only thing on the floor. The rest is the roof.
Right.
And, oh, my God, I wish we could rent that. And she goes, you can. He died 20 years ago, you know. And they had this great little garden area, patio garden, where they had obviously tried to grow a lot of plants.
Right.
But when you got people coming and going and everything like that.
Inconsistent watering.
But they had giant stone pots full of sedum and hens and chicks.
Yep.
That were astounding. That once they had gotten this age, the flowers they produced, the forms they produced, they weren't what you think of.
Right.
You know, once they're given enough room to grow and left alone.
Yeah, and established, and their roots are healthy.
Yeah, they can really take off. If you're interested in green roof technology, sedums are the basis of all.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and that means they're no care, because there ain't nobody up on the green roof.
Exactly.
And it's just that in the sun. That doesn't look like phlox.
It is the moss phlox. It's great for dry. It can take the heat. It can take the sun. And again, it's one of those ones you just sort of plant it and let it go. It doesn't need a ton of water. And actually, if you water it too much, it'll be upset.
Okay, so now specimen species, wildlife value. Tell us what we're looking out here.
Two categories on this table. These are some species I know have really something distinctly interesting. The bottle brush grass gets a really interesting seed head, and sort of it looks like a bottle brush, and it's a lot of nice color, and it goes, you know, through the fall, and it gives you that texture when sort of everything else is winding down. You have that something to look at into the winter.
So wouldn't it be fun to take, I mean, we've like looked at like almost 6 native grasses here.
Yep.
Wouldn't it be fun to mix and match those and have a patch of this? And,
absolutely.
You know, have the little stuff up front, the bigger stuff merging towards the
back.
Yeah,
well, it's like, you know, if you go out and you look at a meadow, it isn't a line of high to low and in between, you know, it's drifts, it's patches, it's like a pocket of goldenrod here and then a tuft of grass here, and you can recreate that in your yard with all these different species and get that variety of color, height, and texture. And it can be in a formal bed if that's what you like, but you can also just sort of do a more natural style.
And here's a plant that apparently attracts rattlesnakes. Is that a good idea?
Rattlesnake master. It's great. Again, you know, it's kind of like the sedum. It can take the dry. It can take the heat. And you can see it's starting to get
the... It looks like it's going to have an amazing flower.
Yeah, the flower head is really incredible. And again, you get sort of that texture with the leaves.
You've been pruning.
Yep.
Yep, stimulate the new growth. The nine bark is another one. It's an amazing plant for, I mean, you can see already the foliage itself is interesting. And then, you know, heading into the late summer, you'll start getting like the cascade of white blossoms. And it, again, you know, if you let it go, it'll just grow and spread and fill in. There's a gigantic one over on the other side of the visitor center. And it's really a wonderful foundation for your garden.
Okay, so these are all nine barks all around here.
Yep.
Okay,
three different varieties.
Yeah, I had heard nothing bad about nine bark.
Yeah,
but it's underutilized.
It is again.
You know, so many plants that are not as used in the landscape as they should be.
Yep.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Ludington Library in Lower Merion on Wednesday evening, October 4th, at the Lower Makefield Township Building on Saturday, October 28th, and I'll deliver the keynote address at the Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Gardens in Pittsburgh during their annual Native Plant and Sustainability Conference on Saturday, October 14th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more perfect native plants for your personal property. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. We are going to go back and review the attributes of even more native plants with Andrew Kirkpatrick of the Schuylkill Valley Nature Center during a special event we held in June for public radio members. And now you get to hear most of the same information those valued members heard last night. Plug, plug, plug. When you're a member of public radio, good things like this can happen to you. Let's get back to my conversation with Andrew. Then we have a very delightful question of the week for you, especially you bird lovers out there.
Okay, so we got shrubs. Where's your... Look, I know there's a big call for the deer resistant.
Deer resistant.
Oh, here we go.
Lucky number 7.
There we go.
So again, nothing is deer proof. You know, if it's tender and young, the deer will go for it. But once it gets established, it'll be less favored and it will go after other plants first. So these are ones for, you know, either taste or smell, the deer don't favor, like the spotted bee balm has sort of that minty smell, and I think the deer kind of stay away from that. And the alum root, again, it's kind of a tough leaf, hairy and thick, not favored.
Now, what a terrible common name.
Most but, unfortunate.
Yeah, but this is a nice plant to have in your garden.
It is, the sneeze weed. Has a almost like a ball for the flower, and it's really a nice one.
And more milkweed.
Yep. Now again, if you have cows or livestock, you don't want to plant milkweed because it will probably kill them. It's highly toxic. But if you want to have butterflies and you don't have cows, it's a great choice.
What about children?
Yeah, it's ingested, it's toxic.
Our child eats things.
Yeah, so you don't want to plant that.
Okay,
yeah, plant raspberries.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We did that.
Yep.
Yeah, one thing I learned from the show, after the second or third year, somebody asked me a question about horses, I just hang up. You know? Because I can only get into trouble.
Right.
More goldenrod.
Another great grass, the pink hair grass.
That's a beautiful.
Really nice pink color into the fall.
Oh, yeah, look at this. See if you can see the picture on this. And now, these are relatively smallish plants.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to take a couple years to establish the size that we see in that picture.
Right, absolutely. But, again, some of these are slower growing, but a lot of these, they're pretty fast. You know, they'll start spreading on their own, and you'll get that size. But, really, it's the second year that you come back to your garden, and you just, this explosion in size.
And here is a plant that no one would be unhappy to take home.
Yep.
Because if you haven't seen this in bloom in person, you can't believe how cute it is.
It's amazing.
The turtle head.
Yep.
And it's a variety called Hot Lips. So what do you know about it?
My chickens eat it, and it keeps coming back all season long.
Okay, that's good. That's good. The flowers are amazing.
Yeah.
The flowers are fairly unique.
Yeah, it sort of has that sort of upright form, and it's kind of almost like a conical shape that the flowers circle around off the top of the seed, the top of the flower head.
And you've also got a white variety.
Yep, that's the straight native that hasn't been selected for the pink color.
Okay. So, you know, then you can put a couple of these in to soothe your guilty conscience.
Yep.
And you can put a couple of the really cool ones in,
for the
too.
Conversation.
Yeah. So, but the point is, whether these are true natives or have been a little bit selected, they're all friendly.
Yes, they're all functioning in the same way. And there's been research into that, too, because there's concern, you know, oh, if I plant the cultivar, will they still come? And people are looking into that, and it seems like, yes, initially they do.
And you also, I mean, I'm so happy to hear you not being didactic.
Yes, it's hard to be.
You know, because you can't. People get to plant a couple of things just for fun.
Yes.
Just for the look of it.
Yes.
You know, mix and match. Have some native plants. Have some plants. You know, don't plant any invasives.
Right.
Or
you need
like
that sort of substitute to bridge you over from your exotic ornamentals into the native world. And the cultivars can kind of give you that splash of variegation to help you along.
But it's all fun.
It is.
And let's do this last grass.
This is another great one. I put it under erosion control because it seemed like it was something that people have looked for in the past. You know, I have a slope that's eroding. What can I plant? Indian grass is a great one. But it's, you know, it's a great plant for any spot. And it'll get really tall. And you can see the roots are already
yep.
You
know, taken over.
Yep. So in the fall, you just get that red color and the red seed heads, and it gets really nice and tall, you know, up to 8 feet. So it can give you that border or the background to plant all your other perennials against and have that texture then throughout the winter.
Oh, and I said that was the last one, but we can't leave this undone because this is a plant that was endangered in the wild.
Yeah.
You know, it was overly harvested for alleged medicinal
use,
which is golden seal. you know, it's a beautiful plant, and you can tell this is going to, these flowers are going to be insane.
Yeah, they're going to pop.
Yeah, and they're a little late according to your time frame here. Golden Seal was, like, considered to be a, quote, heal-all, you know, everything from arthritis to cancer, which meant that whatever you had, you were taking it from the wild. It got really nasty for a while.
Yeah.
It got very hard to find in the wild, so it's good to have. And Bloodroot must be one of your favorites.
That's my all-time favorite. Every spring, you know, starting like late March or April, I wait for my Bloodroot to pop up, and you get that little...
Is this my enemy? Is this Pinella?
No. Is it Pinella or is it the Erysima?
I don't know. This looks like what I've been fighting in my garden.
There's the Erysima.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's not, but,
They're growing next to each other in the nursery, although it might be the Pinella. It is around.
I hate that weed.
I know. Oh, it's so nasty.
But it doesn't feel... Oh, okay. Well...
But, the Bloodroot, you know, you get that nice white blossom, and, it, you know, 2 days, 3 days at the max, and then it's gone. So, you know, you have to be paying attention. You have to be looking at your garden.
Yeah, but the Golden Seal, I mean, this tray is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Very soon. And, oh, you know, that's why I was confused, because Jack in the Pulpit.
Yep.
The Pinella, I thought it was a miniature Jack in the Pulpit.
Ah.
Because it looks that
way. It does. It's a very similar shape.
And so the first year, I didn't pull any of it.
And then you thought you were going to get it.
Oh, man. It is my darkest enemy now.
Yep. Spent many an hour weeding that.
Oh, it's nasty.
Yep. Yeah. Hard to remove.
Because, first of all, it's very attractive. It looks for all the world like a miniature Jack in the Pulpit. And if you leave it alone long enough, it sends up the little pulpit with the cowled head, and Jack is inside. And if you pull it, the stem is kind of weak and white. You pull it really easy. But what you're not getting is a little potato-like tuber underneath. And boy, I've found some. I mean, you can make mashed potatoes out of some of my beds. The you know, the tubers get so big.
Yeah, they'll just come back.
Yeah. Is there any last things that you want to show off here?
The Eastern sweet shrub is really a marvel for a nice deep red color for a long bloom. Great shrub.
And this is like the perfect timing for it right now.
Absolutely.
If you do take this home, please plant it in the evening.
Yes.
And water it deeply. Let a hose just drip at the base of the plant like a drippy faucet for a couple of hours and really let it get established. If you have a gentle hand, even in midsummer, you can put something in the ground like this and not shock it.
Yep.
But as you get into the warmer part of the year, you have to have a gentler hand, and you have to think more about what you're doing. Morning planting is devastating at this time of year. Underwatering early on in the game can be devastating at this time of year. But you plant in the evening, you dig a wide hole, not a deep one, you drip irrigate it, you make sure it gets that drip again for a couple of hours. Any week we don't get rain, and it won't miss a step. So many people don't understand that so many of these plants are understory plants in the wild.
Right. Think about woodland. You know, most things are growing underneath the canopy of trees.
And it almost defies the rule that the more sun, the more flowers.
Right.
But you give a dogwood too much sun, it'll burn up. You give raspberries too much sun and they won't produce.
Yeah.
You give a plant like this too much sun and the flowers won't be as good.
Yep.
And most of us are sun challenged.
True.
And what a great alternative to the coward shade garden.
Yes.
You know, the Holy Trinity. Hostas, impatiens, and begonias, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and here's one of my favorite native bees. Do you see the little?
Yep, flying around.
I'm not sure the scientific name. I got to look at it, but that's one of the golden bees that I see on my plants all the time. They're just remarkable little creatures. They're so much fun to watch. They're my butterflies.
Yeah.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, a companion to our special show on native plants, specifically a list from the Audubon Society of the 10 best native plants to attract birds to your landscape. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with this week's native question.
Sure, Mike. Shelley in Poplar, Wisconsin writes, I want to establish a food source to attract more wildlife to my yard. I have moved some thorn apples, choke cherries, and salmon berries from the wild into my yard. What other plants would attract birds? I live in the very northern part of Wisconsin, so our winters are severe.
As my old friend Curly would say, what a coincidence! The Audubon Society just sent me a list of the 10 best native plants that attract birds to your backyard.
And I happen to know that you've been on the road for like forever this summer and are probably struggling to come up with fresh copy. So, is this even a real email?
You're talking over me. You've been my producer for too long. I'm hurt. This is 100% genuine correspondence from the Badger State.
Okay, I stand corrected. I'm sorry. I shouldn't... Wait a minute. How old is it?
It's 2007. What are you, a cop? Anyway, native plant enthusiast Doug Tallamy helped compile a list of the 10 best native plants for birds for the Audubon Society. And it only came out this month. Okay, last month. Okay, maybe 2015. Again, you know what? You got a warrant or anything here?
My college professors were right. I should have stayed in D.C. Okay, what's number one?
Besides me? Oh, Echinacea, perhaps better known as coneflower, a choice nobody can argue with. They're very pretty plants. They come in a vast array of colors. They aren't fussy about where they grow, and mine always attract a gaggle of goldfinches at the end of the season, feasting on tiny little seeds that I can't even see, but that they go nuts for. And my finches eat them upside down, sitting on top of the plant, their cute little beaks pointed straight towards the ground.
And isn't Echinacea the source of the herbal medicine valerian?
Yeah, but valerian, the sleep aid, preferably comes from a specific species of coneflower, and preferably from the root. And since coneflowers are perennial, most people don't want to dig up the roots.
Ah, and I see that the number two best plant is sunflowers. This is an attractive bird garden.
Yes, indeedy. And all sunflowers look great, from the giant mammoth Russian oilhead types grown for bird seed down to the cutest little ornamental types. And those smaller ornamental sunflowers attract lots of pollinators and beneficial insects, as well as small birds like my finches.
Next is milkweed, which we've covered in depth in past articles that people can look up under the letter M at the A to Z Answers section of our website. But what's cardinal flower?
Cardinal flower? That's a plant that's potentially in line to be the Pope. Oh, geez, okay. Better known as lobelia, its long red tubular flowers attract hummingbirds. The color of the flowers is said to resemble the robes of a cardinal. That's the cleric, not the bird. They're more of like an orangey color, you know.
I'd say enough, but we're only half done.
As if you were the first one to suggest that. Anyway, next up is the trumpet honeysuckle.
That's not the same as the both dreaded and coveted Japanese honeysuckle, is it?
Doug Tallamy would rather chew on ground glass while being dangled over a fire-burning pitch than it ever be thought that he would even tolerate the Japanese species. This is a Native American honeysuckle. Doesn't have a wonderful scent like the Japanese, but it's a magnet for hummers and other birds. And it's well-behaved, which I really can't say for Doug's next choice.
What? I thought Doug Tallamy was the champion of well-behaved plants.
He is the champion of Native American plants, but his next suggestion, Virginia Creeper, shows that behavior is not always on his dance card. This admittedly native vine, often mistaken for poison ivy, but the creeper has five leaves instead of three, quickly takes over any area it's planted near. It is native, but it is also very invasive.
So, pass?
Pass. I don't even like it as a plant, but I'll take hitting 900 any day. Then comes buttonbush, which is the only plant on the list I wasn't familiar with. Doug says it attracts waterfowl, which in my neighborhood is going to mean non-native invasive Canada geese, so that one's not...
Okay, hitting 800. But you love the next plant on the list.
Oh, absolutely. Elderberry has so much going for it that it's almost not fair. It's attractive, it's great for wildlife, and syrups, tinctures, and wines made from the fruits are nature's best antiviral. Perhaps a better protection against the flu than the flu shot.
And the list finishes up with two trees. oaks seem to be here because they provide protection and nesting opportunities.
Yes, oaks have been called the tree of civilization, as they have helped mankind progress in so many ways. But then mankind ignored the hint and planted lots of cheap and crappy Bradford pears. If only the oaks had been in charge!
And we end with my favorite, dogwoods.
Magnificent trees that don't get nearly enough airtime on this show. To quote Doug, nothing says spring quite like a dogwood full of newly bloomed flowers. He adds that cardinals, titmice, and bluebirds all dine on the fleshy fruit of dogwood trees. Well, that sure was some overwhelming information about native plants for birds, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to denature my natives if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location and don't put question in the subject line, okay? They're all questions. What else do you think we get? We don't get anything else other than questions. And we need your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you live, but where you will find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to email us without your location, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. The living legend of Smokey Joe's, Ken Queter, plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Larissa Sapko keep our website from going native. Locally sourced Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor Al Banks is for the birds. Our associate producer Brett Rader says he likes the birdies too. I'm bird watching Mike McGrath, and I'll be back to eight. Hey, wait a minute. I don't want to watch you guys eat my blueberries. That's what the echinacea and sunflowers are for. Oh, well, at least they're not in the... Hey, get out of those raspberries, you woefully wicked winged wheedlers of wretchedness. Bugs, eat my bugs. Read the articles I've written. You're supposed to be eating my bugs, you avian abominations. Bugs, not berries, bugs. Oh, and you guys out there, I'll see you again. Get away from those raspberries, like next week. Get out of those raspberries. Summer is coming to a close, and that means vacation time is in the rearview mirror. I'm Mike McGrath, and I'll be back to work on the next You Bet Your Garden, talking about important end-of-summer topics and once again taking your fabulous phone calls. That's the triumphant return of You Bet Your Garden.